This paper is part of a larger work in which I'm looking at philosophical accounts of divination in antiquity. My overall claim is that they add up to another history of the topic which has yet to be told. We have had robust studies of divination as an important piece of social history, which it clearly was, and as a subset of magic, which it certainly wasn't. We can talk about that. People would like to. But among the philosophers, we find something different. There's a rich tradition running through Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, and the Neoplatonists of treating it as a more or less curious form of cognition. From their widely different stances, these thinkers begin from congruent premises. They observe a group of people that are able to see around corners. They have insights about topics that are not entirely explainable by normal epistemological schemes any of these philosophers construct. And they begin usually by saying, well, there's lots of charlatans out there, but some people seem to be able to do this. And then they ask themselves a question, how in the world do they do it? And with varying degrees of energy and attention, they set about trying to answer that kind of a question. Their studies add up to something like an early history of what I would call intuition. And this is something I'll be pressing for in the book. I'll be focusing this afternoon on the Stoics, who among the ancient schools are attested to have done the most serious thinking in this area. This is ground that's been covered before. There are studies in the bibliography. And one I'd like to highlight that I think is particularly worth attention is Charles Britton. Recently appeared Oxford Studies in Ancient Philosophy. Really interesting paper. And it has helped me form my own ideas. The picture we're able to build of just about any aspect of Stoicism is more tentative than one would like, but despite the tattered nature of the sources, we know about as much of their views on divination as we do about almost anything else from the school. This is thanks in no small part to the survival of Cicero's De Divinatione, to be sure, but given what we know of the Stoic corpus of writings, it's not a fluke. The sources leave no doubt that divination was a subject of abiding interest among them and that it was no tributary but well situated in the main currents of their thinking. In fact, it's fair to say that no other ancient philosophical school took it as seriously as they did. Cicero sets divination in the very citadel of the Stoics. They link the existence of divination with the existence of the gods themselves, and reference to specific works show that they devoted many treatises to the subject. We're told Chrysippus produced four, and Posidonius, a deeply learned man who traveled widely to pursue his scientific investigations and became famous in his day as a polymath and founded his own Stoic school in Rhodes, wrote five books on divination. He was Chrysippus next as the most important figure on the topic. From these works, some traces survive in various sources. We have several pertinent passages from Epictetus and Book 2 of Seneca's Natural History. Overshadowing them all, though, in coherence, size, and importance are Cicero's works on theological matters. Most important of all is the De Div, which provides a wealth of material. This text is by far our most important evidence for Stoic views on the subjects, and I'll be concentrating on it, in particular on a compressed treatment at the close of Book 1, detailing the theory of Posidonius, Cicero's main Stoic source, whose lectures he attended at Rhodes. While all of Book 1 is characterized as being Stoic in its argumentation, not all of it is equally interesting for the present purposes. There are, in fact, just a handful of truly apposite sections, since for whole stretches, Quintus avoids theorizing and just relates famous past examples where an observed sign wound up correlating with some consequential future event. This is actually interesting from a theoretical standpoint because it helps situate the argumentation in a deeply empiricist mode, which is something that there's more to say on, which I won't be saying that much on today. However, at a few places, Quintus speaks directly of theoretical underpinnings. Sections 3 to 5 in Book 1, Section 64, and Section 112 to 129. You'll see the last page of the handout. I've got a schematic overview of the De Div, which I've taken from Wardle, his translation and commentary of a few years ago. Further, with a proper focus on Stoicism, it's more prudent to prune some of these passages to a slightly narrower set. A long tradition of scholarly Quellenforschung has recognized that some of the theoretical material is more peripatetic with little pieces of Platonism in it and likely derives from Cratippus. I will here be taking a conservative approach by concentrating on the evidence at the close of Book 1 directly attributed to Posidonius and widely agreed in the scholarship to represent his views. It starts with an explicit turn in the argument when the dialogue Stoic spokesman, Quintus, says that it's time to address directly how divination works. It starts off section 118. He structures this treatment by referencing a threefold theory of divination, which he credits to Posidonius, the arguments from God, fate, and nature. This division is the most specific précis of any Stoic argumentation that survives in the evidence and will serve as the armature for what I say. First, it's necessary to set out some broader Stoic views of the world. The Stoics are thoroughgoing materialists. Everything that can be said properly to exist for them is material. They allow only four categories of non-material things, which do not strictly exist but subsist as epiphenomena of other things: time, place, predicates, and the void, predicates they call lecta. Except for the last of these, they mostly have the status of informational kinds of coordinates. Time, place, predicates tell you something about a material thing. They give you a coordinate about it. Void gives it a space to be. There's more to say about the incorporeals as the argument develops. Especially relevant for our purposes, even the divine is material. The Stoics define God as an extraordinarily fine mist called pneuma, literally breath, that permeates and suffuses inert matter, or hule, bringing into being everything that exists in the cosmos. The pneuma, which is also coextensive with logos or reason, steers the universe on its course. It is, in fact, the sole active agent in the world. Seneca tells us in text 1 on the handout, our Stoic philosophers, as you know, say that there are two things in nature from which everything is produced, cause and matter. Matter lies inert, an entity ready for anything, but destined to lie idle if no one moves it. Cause, on the other hand, being the same as reason, shapes matter and directs it wherever it wants, and from matter produces its manifold creations. Everything that moves, in other words, is moved by God, pneuma, and the divine breath that suffuses the whole universe. Like the cosmos as a whole, each piece of it is understood to have a kind of dual structure. Each existing thing, whether a rock, a tree, an animal, or a human being, is structured by a portion of pneuma within. It operates like an interior twin, a vaporous body that coexists within the denser one, binding each thing as a whole and making it what it is. The pieces of the world display different levels of complexity and capability that are emergent from different levels of energy in the pneuma, measured in degrees of tension that structures each of them. The Stoics imagine a hierarchy according to these levels of tension. Starting at the low end, they assume they take the name tenor or hexis to a level of pneumatic tension that holds together inanimate objects like stones and logs. Something called phusis, which is a slightly higher state of tension, holds together plants and a human fetus between conception and birth. These are capable of the most basic functions of living things, nutrition and reproduction. Soul, or psuche, an even higher form of pneuma, adds perception and locomotion and holds together the matter of which an animal is made up. Soul that has the power of soul has the powers of sensation and movement. The logical soul, the logike psuche, which is the most energetic form, holds together the inert matter that underlies the human being and uniquely manifests the characteristic of logos, or speech and reason. Shifting back to the macrocosm, the total collectivity of the internal structuring elements of all the entities in the cosmos adds up to a seamless, cohesive whole. The pneuma inside each thing functionally leaks out beyond the perimeter of whatever entity it gives shape to, and since even the atmosphere of the surrounding air itself is permeated by pneuma, it fills all the gaps in between discrete objects, making a continuous flow in the aggregate. This adds up to God and constitutes the soul of the world. And just as in the case of individual entities, the world soul that makes the cosmos into a whole massive unified body, populated inside itself with various objects, including inert ones, and also creatures that are alive and capable of motion, and plants and all the others, and even you and I, capable of logic and reason. Since the universe contains such creatures, it itself has all these capacities. The degree of tension present in its pneuma must be at least as high as the highest entities within it. Because of this, it makes sense for them to speak of the cosmos as a living creature, capable of motion and sensation, and permeated by a sensing, aware, intelligent, and reasoning pneuma. The whole picture comes into focus in an attestation from Diogenes Laertius, which is text 2. Chrysippus says that the cosmos is a rational, ensouled, intelligent creature in the first book of his On Providence, and Apollodorus says it in his Physics, and Posidonius too. It is an animal in this way, it is a substance endowed with soul and perception. For the living creature is greater than what is not living, and nothing is greater than the cosmos, so the cosmos is a living creature. It is ensouled, as is clear from our souls being a fragment of it. Then studying the inclinations of the world also means getting to know the wills, desires, and impulses of an exceptionally large creature, that is, God itself. Its continuous character creates connections between things. This view, consistently articulated as a central piece of Stoic physics, provides a powerful premise for explaining how divinatory signs could be connected with the meanings they convey. The Stoic thinker contemplating how a certain flight of a bird or cleft of a liver might be connected with some future event can rely on the capacious power of the divine, which flows from one point to the next and furnishes the links in a whole network of causal chains that interconnect the cosmos. These interconnections are the central innovation of the Stoic school that is relevant for divination, and they consistently travel under the same technical term. The Stoics label this property sympatheia, or sympathy. So getting into Posidonius' threefold argument. The closing theoretical section of the De Div, Book 1, runs from 118 to 132. And you'll see that's my own arrangement of how the material is. Wardle has a slightly different starting point for where the argument, threefold argument, begins, and I'll explain that in just one second. The closing theoretical section, then, he directly attributes to Posidonius in text 3. It seems to me that, as Posidonius has done, the whole force and rationale of divination should be traced first from God, about whom enough has been said, secondly from fate, and then from nature. Directly after invoking Posidonius, Quintus moves into the arguments from fate, 125 to 128, and then from nature, 129 to 32. With respect to the argument from God, Quintus's statement that already enough has been said about it invites a search for it early in the dialogue. I'll be taking this as a reference to sections 118 to 24. There are other interpretations of what the argument from God is. I'd be happy to talk about them if anyone wants to get into what they are and why I think that 118 to 25 actually is the beginning point, the argument from God in Posidonius' scheme. And in this, I agree with Britton, but not with Wardle, interestingly. Wardle has a different point of it. 118 begins with the pivot in the argument I mentioned above. Quintus starts with, but it seems necessary to determine how divination works. And then he goes off and starts talking about things that, in my view, are centrally focused on God. So with this overarching statement about Posidonius as the source, this is, in my reading, coming between parts 1 and 2, and situates the entire whole within the larger work. Some have tried to map the parts of the argument as applying to different kinds of divination, but this is not supportable. And further, in each part, Posidonius makes a point of raising how such an argument, whichever argument he's making, applies across both technical and natural forms, the two largest groupings of divinatory types. So in God, fate, and nature, we're not going to get argumentation about one kind of divination versus another. All three are meant to apply to all kinds of divination. Starting with the argument from God. It begins with the following sentence at the opening of 118, which directly follows the introductory one that states we have to look at how divination works, and it starts with text 4 on the handout. For it is not Stoic doctrine that the gods are concerned with every single fissure of livers, with every bird song, for that is neither appropriate nor worthy nor in any way possible, but that the world was created from the beginning in such a way that predetermined signs would precede predetermined events. Some in entrails, others in birds, others in lightning, others in portents, others in the stars, others in the visions of dreamers, and others in the utterances of those inspired. Earlier Stoics, like Chrysippus and Antipater, faced criticism from Carneades, the Epicureans, and others, including one of their own, Panaetius, for having their divine principle too deeply implicated in the details of individual divinatory signs. Their detractors characterized them as claiming that God was involved ad hoc in sending person-to-person messages, analogous to traditional accounts like Homer's. This invited the charge of cheapening the divine, making God into a kind of busybody concerned with quotidian minutiae. Posidonius is distancing himself from such a characterization. In his estimation, the machineries of the world are just set up in such a way that events unfold with predictable precursors. The opening of the argument from God, then, is a limiting one. However, as becomes clear as he advances, this will not remove God from the picture. But there are two further points of note that emerge from the opening statement. First, the argument co-implicates at the outset a notion of predetermination, along with a statement about the way the world works, which is proximate to a statement about nature. It's clear from this beginning that the threefold argument will best be understood as a set of three perspectives on a single phenomenon, rather than as a succession of treatments of discrete parts. Each of them, God, fate, and nature, invokes the other two in making its case. Second, Posidonius has an overarching theory of all modes of divination in mind. While his statement about how the world was constructed with an interlocking causal architecture is clearly relevant to artificial divination, he tells us it is pertinent also to natural divination. Dreams and oracles, in other words, are part of the predetermined setup of correlative events. The synthetic way of looking at these two modes is mostly unprecedented, and best seen as an expression of the Stoics' strongly materialist views on the soul. For both Plato and Aristotle, in their different ways, the soul is something quite different from the material succession of causes according to which external events unfold. So, discussions of premonitions that arrive to a prescient soul, something in which they're both interested, will be something quite different from divination by signs embedded in the external world and interpreted by art, something which neither of them is much interested. By contrast, the Stoics' materialist view of the soul allows, and in fact requires, that the soul is now fully embedded within the interlocking set of physical causes that produce coming events. On these grounds, a Stoic argument that appeals to a consistent association between an outcome and a precursor in the natural world is not different in kind from an appeal to a precursor in an individual soul. A claim that certain birds are provoked to song by currents leading to some future event is entirely analogous to a claim that certain souls are provoked to some utterances or dreams by those currents. On first look, with this statement, that the gods are not busybodies, it seems as though Posidonius is claiming that divine signs unfold without divine involvement at each step. But this would be odd, perhaps even a bit perverse, given the core Stoic idea of God as the sole active agent in the universe. Surely it can't be the case that every change that happens happens via the divine, except in the case of divine signs. And in fact, in the successive stages of the argument from God, he speaks about how fully the divine is involved. Following his opening remarks, Quintus makes the main argument of this section, text 5. Once this has been set down and agreed that there is a certain divine power which encloses the lives of men, it's not hard to imagine by what means those things happen, and which we clearly see do happen. He goes on to make a series of direct appeals to the pervasive divine force that steers the universe. He considers divination by entrails and tells us that a sentient force, power, which pervades the whole world can guide in the choice of sacrificial victim, and at the very moment when you intend to sacrifice, a change of entrails can take place so that something is either added or taken away. The divine shapes the process at two levels, first in guiding the choice of victim, and second in manipulations of the organs. The point is made finer as he continues and discusses the famous episode in which Caesar foresaw his death when a sacrificed bull was found with no heart, and the next day one was found with a liver missing a part. Since without the heart the bull could not have been alive before the sacrifice, which it clearly was, Posidonius reasons that it must have been somehow taken away, and, well, as Quintus argues, putting it in the mouth of Posidonius, he's inserting the tale after the fact. And reasons that the divine, in the form of the sentient force, is the only possible cause of such a thing. He continues with the claim that the divine spirit does the same thing in the case of birds, when it acts as the cause behind both their twitchy movements and their impulsive screeches. It also sends signs, like eclipses, prodigious births, portentous dreams, and other strange occurrences. And so Posidonius' opening claim, rejecting that God is concerned with every bird song or fissure in a liver, is obviously not a ruling out of divine involvement entirely. The argument doesn't really make sense if that's what he's claiming in the opening piece. A sharper focus on the formulation inter esse deum, which shows up in text 4, helps to clarify what he is up to. What he argues against is that each thing that happens in a divinatory moment is of interest to, or concern to, or importance to, the divine. In other words, he's ruling out the idea of an individually oriented ad hoc communication, which would be the result of some situation-specific desire by a god to send a message. Rather, we have a pervasive divine force that is present everywhere, renders certain nodal points of seemingly unsystematic aleatory events, like twitching bird songs or movements, flitting dream images, odd births, choice of this or that sacrificial victim, it renders those into a large interconnected machine that is, in fact, not at all unsystematic. At each step, the divine is, as always, the ultimate active agent bringing about each outcome, and it functionally rules out happenstance because of this. The divine steers the world as the divine always does, irrespective of the incremental good or bad outcomes that might accrue to individual entities at the granular level, but with the overall meliorous sweep to which the Stoics were committed. So the divine is involved, it just doesn't make a concern out of individual acts of communication. The divine is involved in all these pieces, though. As the sole agent of this larger system, the divine provides the foundation for it staying organized at all levels. It undergirds the disparate events, renders what might seem like a throng into an order, and so renders it sensible and predictable. Cicero's particular language yields insight as well, and this is something that's helped inspired to notice on the basis of what's happening with power ontologies and our talks in Brussels. Cicero's particular language yields insight as well. He typically represents this function of the divine as the ordering power behind all things via the term vis, which nearly all translators render sensibly enough into the English force. It's easy enough on this translation to understand it as a generalizing energy moving through the cosmos. But in my view, there's likely something more specific behind the vis, given the frequency with which Cicero uses the term in reference to the divine role in divination. And it shows up in sections 12, 118, and 125 of book one. And at each point when he's groping for a broad statement about what divination is, vis shows up. It's likely that he's reflecting an underlying consistency in his Greek source material, again, mostly Posidonius. The most likely candidate for the Greek equivalent behind the Latin vis is dunamis. Within Greek more broadly, this term speaks of things like force or power, but within Stoicism, it has an illuminating special sense. The term takes on an important role in Stoic psychology. It is a means by which they clarify how they understood the soul to function. While our souls, according to the Stoics, are monistic configurations of pneuma, they're uniform throughout. They extend uniformly through the body, and the Stoics don't have different pieces of the soul the way Plato does and Aristotle does. And in fact, for Plato and Aristotle, those distinctions are really important in theorizing divination. Divination doesn't happen via the highest order part of the soul. In both Plato and Aristotle, happens by the low part of the soul. And it's a kind of a recompense to that part of the soul that it occasionally gets to partake of this ability to see stuff. The Stoics don't have that divided soul. So instead, they have this monistic soul that extends uniformly throughout the body. But at the same time, the soul obviously has discrete functions. It does different things. When they talk about these different functions, they allow themselves to speak of certain distinctions in the soul. They make reference to two different kinds of taxonomies in this context. First, the sources attest to the idea of the soul having parts in the sense of it extending to different areas inside the physical body. There's an eightfold discussion attested in two sources that speaks of a central part that remains in the chest and the seven parts extending out from and seven other parts extending out from there, one each to the sensory organs, another to the throat, and another to the genitals. These tentacles of pneuma, and the octopus metaphor comes up in the sources, the tentacles of pneuma regulate different kinds of activities. Those to the sense organs manage each kind of sensation. That to the throat regulates speech. That to the genitals, reproduction. And that which stays on in the center takes on the role of commanding part in which the executive functions take place. From these different functions, the second form of taxonomy arises, by which they express the different powers in the soul. And it's these that the Stoics call dunamis. They use the category to express a kind of disposition of a soul that allows it to produce and regulate a certain discrete set of mental events. The sources attest to four psychic dunamis. There's presentation, what appears via the senses, assent, that's the power to verify a particular appearance as being the real thing and not just a phantom. So presentation and assent, then impulse, which is a propulsion to action, and reason. Following Brad Inwood's reconstruction of the details, the Stoics have a fully worked out idea of how actions happen in ensouled creatures. Briefly, presentations arrive from the parts of the soul extended to the senses. The commanding part can at that point assent to the presentation or not, making kind of certification of its authenticity. The reasoning function then concludes what kind of action to take and sends out an impulse, triggering appropriate action to make it happen. The last dunamis, impulse, will become important later in the discussion. It comes in many different varieties, including one that's future-oriented, which is going to be of much interest to me. It's the power that precipitates action in the world. This is a particular subclass. There's a particular subclass of it as well that, as I said, I'll be looking at. Now, given that God is, by Stoic definition, precisely a soul, and further, a rational soul, when Posidonius speaks of the powers by which divination works as unfolding according to the divine dunamis, we're right to seek clarification of this claim from broader ideas on how souls operate. And further, we're quite authorized to do this by another well-attested view in Stoic theology. Turning to text 7. According to the Stoics, the world is not just like a creature from the vantage of its larger architectural organization, it's also correlate to one in the mechanics of its behaviors. In his De Natura Deorum, Cicero quotes Zeno as calling nature a craftsman-like fire, and he continues, this is text 7, the nature of the world itself, which encloses and contains all things in its embrace, is styled by Zeno not merely craftsman-like, but actually a craftsman, whose foresight plans out the work to serve its use and purpose in every detail. And as the other natural substances are generated, reared, and sustained each by its own seeds, so the world nature experiences all those motions as well, whose those impulses of conation and desire that the Greeks call hormai. And it follows these up with the appropriate actions in the same way as we do ourselves, who experience emotions and sensations. Such being the nature of the world, mind, it can therefore correctly be designated as prudence or providence. For the Greeks, it is termed pronoia. So the universe works like a sentient creature in its details, too. It is not just that the world is set up on the whole with abstract wills and desires. It also has an apparatus for executing these actions based on these wills and desires that parallels what we see in individual creatures, individual ensouled creatures. And like the highest kind of ensouled creatures, humans with rationality, it also behaves with rational thinking. It has perception, and it also has impulse that we saw the Stoics talking about in their psychology. I will here proceed by considering that when Cicero refers to divinations operating according to a wis, he is reflecting Greek dunamis in his source and is referencing a psychic mechanism of the cosmic creature. Up to this point, the most that could be claimed, I think the most that could be claimed is that Posidonius' argument allows such a reading. But as we get to the end of it, in my view, it requires it. Taking into account the psychology will provide resources to sort out two further claims, one each in the arguments from fate and nature, which are, I think, otherwise impenetrable. Argument from fate. In the argument from fate, Posidonius links his explanation of divination to a widely attested Stoic idea of the deterministic and so predictable character of the cosmos. What happens in the universe does not just spring up out of nowhere, it has prior causes. Text 8. Things which are, do to be, do not suddenly spring into existence, but the evolution of time is like the unwinding of a cable. It creates nothing new and only unfolds each event in its order. Stoic ideas of determinism flow from the positions we've already seen them stake out. Since nothing happens outside of the divine architecture of interlocking causes, nothing happens that is causally underdetermined from what comes before. This means that knowledge of the state of affairs at one time allows for inferences about what the state of affairs will be at a future time. Full knowledge would mean an ability to make perfect inferences. Posidonius considers this as a limit case, which has a air about it of the Stoic idea of a wise man. If there were a man, text 9, whose soul could discern the links that join each cause with every other cause, then surely he would never be mistaken in any prediction that he might make. For he who knows the causes of future events necessarily knows what every future event will be. But since such knowledge is possible only to a god, it is left to man to presage the future by means of certain signs which indicate what will follow. understanding a deterministic causal nexus undergirds artificial divination rather unproblematically. There's actually one thing that's somewhat interesting that comes up when you start to pursue this, and that has to do with artificial divination. The problem is not how artificial divination works according to this way of looking at things. The problem is what would count as only what would count as specifically divination, as opposed to any other kind of empirical prediction. So, you know, predicting rain from a rain cloud presumably doesn't make you a diviner, but it, you know, makes you something else. Or from animal behaviors, if you know a lot about animals and you're, or plants, you're a botanist, or you're an expert in oysters, or whatever you are. But for them, they get pressed on that and come up with an idea that says that no, what divination does is predict things that happen, are thought to happen according to chance. This is something that we can talk about more too. The Stoics have a specific definition of what chance is. It doesn't come up in Book One. Cicero, in the guise of an academic skeptic in Book Two, makes hay of the claim that anything would happen by chance in a deterministic cosmos. And there's an interesting tension between the two points. Thought to happen by chance is the important qualifier for Book One. So, in addition to the line of thinking, so we've got this deterministic cosmos, fate works perfectly for artificial divination. In addition, though, by the line of thinking developed in the argument from God, according to which dreams and the visions of oracular diviners are also enfolded into the succession of causal links, it would also undergird natural divination. So, just as these things are linked to future events, so also certain kinds of things that appear in dreams or in utterances of oracles are going to be linked to future divination. However, in this section, Posidonius's argument also marks out that there's a difference. While both artificial and natural diviners are aware of the sequential consistency of causes, only artificial diviners are able to see only correlations, not underlying causes. Posidonius tells us that those performing natural divination, on the other hand, actually do see the causes. Text 10. So it comes about that on the one hand, it can be known by observation what effect generally follows each cause, even if it doesn't always follow, for it is difficult to affirm that. On the other hand, it is probable that the very causes of future effects are perceived by those who see them in frenzy or in sleep. This requires a little bit more digging. What is it that Posidonius is claiming those dreaming or in a frenzy see? To understand this requires a comment a closer look at how the Stoics think of a cause. A cause for the Stoics is emphatically a material body that acts on another material body. They speak of causation always by making reference to two material bodies. The Stoics, text 11, say that every cause is a body which becomes the cause to a body of something incorporeal. For instance, the scalpel, a body, becomes the cause to the flesh, a body, of the incorporeal predicate being cut. And again, the fire, a body, becomes a predicate to the wood, a body, of the incorporeal predicate being burnt. It is unlikely that Posidonius means that those who are sleeping see simple material bodies. When he says cause, they see the causes of things. First thing we might think of is to think of just a material body. I think it's unlikely that that's what he's claiming they see. The problems with this would be multiple. We have no solution for how the senses would work when shut off in sleep. And even if we did, it's difficult to imagine how a visual mental picture of the exterior of an object would lead to a window into its future state. So just sort of seeing an orange doesn't tell you that it's going to decay and then sprout into an orange tree. I mean, it doesn't see that, it sees the orange. This brings up a further consideration on cause. When one body becomes a cause of a predicate to another, the body that is acted on also has a causal role in the process. As we saw, each individual body in the cosmos has its own internal structure, being held together by a certain configuration of pneuma at a certain degree of tension. This internal nature shapes the end effect of any external bodies that act on it. As Suzanne Bobsian has shown, this dimension of a material body has the status of a cause. So we have external causes that provoke effects from the outside, while the internal ones do so from the structures within the affected body. Cicero uses the example of a cylinder at the top of an incline. On one level, a finger, if it pushes, is the cause of the cylinder rolling. but the cylinder's own disposition, that is, its roundness with respect to its horizontal axis, is also a cause. Just as the cylinder's rolling has a cause built into it, so also all bodies have built into them the dispositions that will unfold in the causal chains to come. This will be true in the case of more complex bodies. Their internal structures will be factors in any causal situation in which they're involved. In fact, this is the point of the cylinder example when Chrysippus brings it up. He uses it to argue that our acts of ascent and the different powers that we have inside of our soul are not determined fully by external causes. So he can talk about a deterministic universe in which people can still be held responsible because their internal state has a role to play in any causal thing that they're involved in. And they have a responsibility over tending to their internal states. All of this is perfectly consonant with their view of the pneuma as the sole active agent in the cosmos. The point was made sharply in the citation from Seneca, which the Stoics can call this suffusing divine pneuma simply cause. Text 1. Pneuma is a cause. None of this runs afoul of the Stoic insistence that a cause must be a material body, since an internal configuration of pneuma is categorically material. It's a material body. The next clue to understand what cause the natural diviners might see comes from a prominent Stoic category that Posidonius' argument relies on in the next step in the argument from fate, and one that we've already run into in an earlier text. It's in text 12. It's not amazing that those things which exist nowhere are known in advance by diviners. All things exist, but they are absent from the standpoint of time. As in seeds, there is present the wis of those things which are produced from the seeds, so in causes are stored the future events which the soul perceives, either when in frenzy or set free in sleep, or which reason or conjecture sense in advance. Since the Stoics, providing inspiration to Augustine in his Confessions, Book 11, see an infinitesimal present and a past and a future that do not properly exist but only subsist in the mode of incorporeals, this raises an interesting problem when it comes to divinatory knowledge. He wants to provide an answer to the question, if something has only a quasi-existence, that is the future, subsists, what is there to be comprehended of the future by an observer? The answer here comes in the form of the seed. At several consequential points in their thinking, the Stoics use the seed analogy to talk about future-oriented causation. It's actually quite broadly appealed to in different pieces of Stoicism. Sextus Empiricus tells us that the idea of the seed is so implicated in their idea of causation that it's able to stand as a proxy for the cause itself. Quoting Sextus, I don't have this text printed out, but Sextus tells us, if seed exists, the Stoics say, cause also exists, since seed is the cause of things which grow and are generated from it. The Stoic mode of speaking about the male seed as an extension of psuche to the genitals is relevant here, as is their custom of talking about the underlying reason that guides the universe as spermatikoi logoi. These are the principles that govern normal, unexceptional growth and development, as well as all the other seemingly aleatory events that we considered above. The divine has planted these seeds in the cosmos, which operate in and through the medium of pneuma. A poetic statement of this survives in a citation of Cleanthes, preserved in Stobaeus, text 13. Just as all the parts of a single thing grow from seeds at the proper times, so too the parts of the world, which include animals and plants, grow at their proper times. Further, just as the particular logoi of the parts come together and is coming together in a seed, mingle and in turn separate as the parts are generated, so also things arise from one thing, and from all things, one thing is composed, as the cycle proceeds systematically and harmoniously. Future states, then, exist insofar as they are buried inside material bodies. By this logic, the quasi-existence of the future that would be capable of being detected in the present is the anticipatory set of causal vectors built into the pneuma within each body. In its seed-like dimension is the point. It's there like a coiled spring. It's waiting to go. And if you can see it, you know what the mechanism is going to do. I propose that this is precisely what Posidonius means when he speaks of a natural diviner as perceiving the very causes which are not perceptible to the artificial diviner. But there's a little bit more to the story to get to this point. Internal causes, and not that much more, a little bit more. Internal causes will vary. On one level, this means that one thing will be round and another square. That's the cause at the level of hexes, or non-living things, determining the exterior shape and color and those kind of things. But they'll also vary, internal causes will vary also more consequentially according to the degree of tension that the material body carries. Physical shape is an example at the low end, and the seed-like dimension at the low end is no more complex than the cylinder's rollability. So that internal tension that's making it into a cylinder, you could observe from the outside and see what it's going to do by seeing that it's going to roll. Now, moving up the scale, though, from hexes to a fusus to a psuche to a logike psuche, each of these also contain within themselves a set of possibilities, and these are contained in more complex dimensions of the seeds that they carry. Within the highest order, the logike psuche, we find a certain disposition toward action in each of them, and it's of greater interest to the present question. Here we recall the Stoic discussion of the soul's four dunamis, or powers. We saw that among them is impulse, Greek hormai, impulses, which the Stoics thought of as a movement of the soul towards something. Hormai is a movement towards something. A detailed testimony on impulse from Arius Didymus, Doxography, and his Doxography of Stoic Ethics is preserved in Stobaeus. A careful reading of it by Brad Inwood has teased out a dozen classes in a tiered hierarchy of impulse. It's quite a display. Since they are movements of a soul towards something, all of these impulses emerge only at the top end of the scale of nature, soul and logical soul, not in phusis or in hexes. Different classes of impulse are appropriate to the different kinds of being. Instinctual movement, as the kind that we see in animals, is one thing, but that resulting from logical consideration by a human being is another thing. Within the rational hormai, there are further subclasses. So within those that go to a human being, there are further subclasses. One class produces motion now. It's called an orexis. This is the same thing that animals have. They just do things now. They just do them. Humans do this as well. But there's also another class of impulses, movements toward action, that are oriented toward future events. This is a subclass of impulse of an impulse called an orusis. An example that Inwood offers is helpful. He constructs the case. One has a presentation of a neighbor bearing a treasure in his yard. One uses one's reason that it would be right to steal that when possible, and that's a mistaken reason, but one makes that conclusion. One then assents to this by an assent, saying, yep, good thing, and then forms an impulse to dig up that treasure as soon as the neighbor leaves town. This counts as an impulse. It's an orusis. This impulse will be a material configuration of the internal pneumatic state of a logike psuche. This greatly expands on the kinds of things that could be foreseen when people see the causes themselves. Presently existing seeds of future events contained in complex, everything around us, including complex things like human beings. It opens up a source of predictive data contained in the most inscrutable and significant of all entities inside individual human beings. Finally, on this score, in the text above at least, the power of the seed is expressed with the power, the wis that we saw suggested earlier, is connected to the details of Stoic psychology. We would need more to go on to conclude anything, but it suggests that within the seed, as a cause, there is a dunamis, that is, a power of a soul, to produce a certain consistent set of events. But on one level, this could be seen as a category error. Seeds come up in relation to all things in the world, which would include bodies at the low end, but non-living things like a cylinder don't have souls, and so we can't really talk about them as having dunamis. Dunamis only show up at the higher end. And only things at the higher end would have these potentially detectable oruses inside of them. There's one way around this, though, and it's enticing. We recall that the Stoic invitation in Text 7 to consider the whole world as operating like a unified organism, even down to the mechanics, including understanding that the universe has seeds, according to, that shows up in Text 7, has seeds according to which it experiences motions of will and impulses and hormai, the Greek technical term, and it follows these up with appropriate actions. From the perspective of the soul of the world, impulses toward motion are operative through and through. So even in the part of the world that's non-living, it's enveloped by this larger living force that will have future-oriented impulses activated in it. So on this level, it's not a category mistake to claim that impulses, and even more pertinently, future-leaning impulses, are there for the sensing, even in the case of the low end of the capillaries of the world. Out in these capillaries of the universe, the world soul's impulses are going to be present. The very causes the divining soul sees are these, I claim. A final part of the story, not yet addressed, is how Posidonius proposes that this sensing of impulse is supposed to happen. That we have a transfer of information encoded in the pneuma is not a problem. This is standard Stoic thinking. Pneuma is the great carrier of logos. It's not hard to imagine that there's some reasoning, sensible, intellectual content carried through pneuma. That's not a problem. But typically, the bits of data are sent and received by the sense organs. They work; they all work pneumatically, and we have sense organs that are operative and pick up this data from the outside world. But the soul that can sense these causes, in the claim that he's making, does not have access to its functional sensory mechanics. Its powers are disabled because of sleep or frenzy. The verb in each instance, talking about some apprehension of these causes in text 10 and 12, is kerno. So they discern. It's not much help because it's so general, but it's also perhaps of some help since its generality suggests that it won't be an act of perception of the normal sort. The argument from nature makes it clear what he has in mind, and this is where I'll conclude, and this is a very short piece. Almost done. The statement of Posidonius' argument from nature is more compressed than the other two. The core text is stated in core of the argument is stated in a short section of text, which I produced for you as text 14. From nature comes another particular argument, which teaches us how great the power of the soul is when it is separated from the physical senses, which happens most of all either when people are sleeping or mentally inspired. Because as the minds of the gods understand what each other is thinking without eyes, ears, and tongues, on the basis of this, men, when they make a silent wish or vow, do not doubt the gods hear them, so men's souls, when they are released by sleep, are free of the body, or stirred by inspiration, and roused, move freely, of their own accord, discern those things which they cannot see when they are mixed up with the body. It is highly unlikely that this claim of the soul moving freely of its own accord is meant as an out-of-body experience. Sometimes people take it to be that. And it's true that in Stoicism there's a handful of mentions of free-floating demons. Handful, not that many. Maybe only really two, which are potentially the souls of the dead. But there's nothing that speaks of people's souls temporarily leaving the bodies they structure. It's easy to understand why. While Plato's dualism, for example, would allow that such a thing could be considered, the Stoics have no way of even doing that, even poetically or speculatively. If the pneuma inside of any entity somehow left it, all that would remain would be this gray ash of unformed hule. It's not like your soul could just leave you for a while you're sleeping and come back. So we're not talking about free movement of soul in a kinetic sense of it orbiting around and seeing things. That just can't be the case. Instead, Posidonius is telling us that we have a pneumatic principle, our soul, untethered from its day-to-day functions that it's normally required to superintend. And so in that sense, it's free to be affected, that is, to be moved. So it's free to move in the sense of being moved by all the stuff that's happening around it. And it's going to be moved, I think he must be claiming here, in interaction with the atmospheric residue of the other configurations of pneuma in its proximity. Note again that the verb is kerno. He must have in mind direct pneuma to pneuma transfers of information, like the gods give. This would not need fairy dust to happen, just contact, since via sympathy, all things are in contact with all things. That problem is already solved. We already have contact.